from Malcolm Cowley's A Blue Giunietta. Not that the pines were darker there, nor mid-May dogwood brighter there, nor swifts more swift in summer air. It was my own country. Having its thunderclap of spring, its long midsummer ripening, its corn horse-stiff at harvesting, almost like any country. Yet being mine, its face, its speech, its hills bent low within my reach, its river birch and upland beach were mine, of my own country. Now the dark waters at the bow fold back like earth against the plough. Foam brightens like the dogwood now, at home in my own country.
Physician and writer Abraham Verghese. He'll be back in just a moment with more from his book, My Own Country, A Doctor's Story of the Battle Against AIDS in the Contemporary South. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Abraham Verghese was born in Ethiopia in 1955 of Southern Indian Christian parents. After medical school, he came to Johnson City, Tennessee for an internship and residency. He then went on to Boston for special training in infectious diseases. In the mid-80s, when Dr. Verghese returned to Johnson City, he found himself dealing more and more with HIV and AIDS, which soon became the focus of his career. He also discovered that as an outsider, a foreigner himself, he could talk openly with people who might otherwise have been suspicious. In 1990, Abraham Verghese moved to Iowa, where he worked at the University of Iowa Outpatient AIDS Clinic. He also attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which encouraged him to turn his experience in the South into a book. It's called My Own Country, A Doctor's Story. With an excerpt from My Own Country, here is Abraham Verghese.
Summer 1985. A young man is driving down from New York to visit his parents in Johnson City, Tennessee. I can hear the radio playing. I can picture his parents waiting, his mother cooking his favorite food, his father pacing. I see the young man in my mind, despite the years that have passed. I can see him driving home along a route that he knows well and that I have traveled many times. He started before dawn. By the time it gets hot, he has reached Pennsylvania. 300 or so miles from home, he begins to feel his chest tighten. He rolls up the windows. Soon, chills shake his body. He turns the heater on full blast. It is hard for him to keep his foot on the accelerator or his hands on the wheel. By the time he reaches Virginia, the chills give way to a profuse sweat. Now he is burning up, and he turns on the air conditioner, but the perspiration still soaks through his shirt and drips off his brow. His lungs feel heavy, as if laden with buckshot. His breath is labored, weighted by fear and perhaps by the knowledge of the burden he is bringing to his parents. Maybe he thinks about taking the next exit off Interstate 81 and seeking help, but he knows that no one can help him, and the dread of finding himself sick and alone keeps him going. That and the desire for home. I know the stretch of highway that cuts through the Virginia mountain. I know how the road rises, sheer rock on one side, how in places the kudzu takes over and seems to hold up a hillside, and how, in the early afternoon, the sun glares directly into the windshield. He would have seen hay rolled into tidy bundles lined up on the edges of fields, and tobacco plants and sagging sheds with their rusted, corrugated tin roofs and shutterless side openings. It would all have been familiar, this country, his own country.
Dr. Abraham Verghese, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Congratulations on this wonderful book that you have written. What took you to Johnson City, Tennessee?
Well, I came to Tennessee for the first time in 1980. I was part of this annual huge influx of foreign medical graduates who come to America. We come partly in search of this, you know, wonderful ideal of Western medicine, the pinnacle of Western medicine. But we also come because there's a huge need for foreign doctors to run the inner city hospitals, the Cook County, Chicago, the Harlem hospitals, kind of county hospitals that couldn't get manpower otherwise. American graduates are loath to go there. And I had the sense that I wanted to step off this beaten track, and I heard about and found this new residency in a new small medical school in East Tennessee. So I did my internship and residency there, and then went off to Boston to do my infectious disease training. And when I was done, I had the sense that I had just been enormously attracted to that part of the country, the people. Mm-hmm. And I decided that this was going to be my own country. This was going to be the place I raised my kids. And part of it was a strong sense of needing a place to call home. I was born in Africa, but of Indian parents, and I had most of my education in Africa, where my parents were school teachers. I even began my medical education there, and then because of war, was displaced and went to India, a land I didn't know very well till then, and then came to America. So I had the sense that I had finally found the particular geography to define my destiny.
Now, we talk in this country a lot about multiculturalism and being cross-disciplinary and interdisciplinary. I say this to you because it's a mixed bag when you talk about having these such cross-cultural roots and elements in your life. You really were a kind of an exotic plant in the Southern Garden, weren't you?
I certainly was. I was really a different kind of a plant, as you put it.
Right. How did all of that work? I mean, was that with trepidation or with a sense of optimism that with this variegated background of your own that you came to not the Deep South, but the South?
Well, I think one of the things that this background of mine gave me was I was always adept at picking up on the cultural nuances and almost chameleon-like finding ways to blend in.
Right.
And that actually became an advantage as time went on, because the men that I came to take care of ultimately in this story were outsiders of a different sort. I mean, mm-hmm. I was an alien and so were they. We were kind of aliens at cross purposes. I was trying to fit in, and they were, for the most part, hometown boys who were alien and had actually left the town,
right,
and were now coming back.
What is it that drew you to infectious disease, the practice of medicine that involves infectious disease, sexually transmitted diseases, and then eventually here you end up working, as I understand it, almost exclusively with AIDS patients?
Pretty much, yeah. I went into infectious disease in the pre-AIDS days because it was the one specialty in my mind that was associated with cure.
Mm-hmm.
I saw cardiology and many other specialties as ultimately not reversing the fundamental disease process that was going on. You played around with fancy and expensive catheters, but you didn't change anything.
Right.
Infectious disease in its heyday, you could treat someone with an exotic disease like Legionnaire's disease or a tropical infection, or in a transplant patient or leukemic, you could basically make the difference between their living and dying. And so it was all about cure. I was caught up in the conceit of cure.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tell this to medical students now, they find it actually incredibly funny, because I guess my specialty has become associated with anything but cure. It's
right.
Funny for them to hear me say why I went into infectious disease.
Yeah, the tunnel, it gets longer and the light recedes there at the end of it. Are you frustrated? Do you find yourself, looking back on these years with mixed feelings or a sense of satisfaction?
Well, I have a sense of satisfaction, but I must honestly say that if I had to do it again, and not knowing exactly how big AIDS would be, I'm not sure what choice I would make. And I'm
mm-hmm.
really inspired to see young people choosing to go into infectious disease, knowing what I certainly didn't know when I embarked on it. I'm not frustrated. I actually feel a sense of discovery. I think that we were so caught up in this conceit of cure that when AIDS came along and we had no cure, it forced us to discover the other facet of medicine that has atrophied in this country, which is the facet that has to do with healing.
Mm-hmm.
To use a very crude analogy, and I'm not using healing as as one of these new age terms, not in that sense as much as to use an analogy. If you've ever had your apartment broken into and your stereo and your radio taken, if the police come back an hour later and give it back to you, you've been cured, but you've not been healed. You still feel violated.
Yeah, you can't reverse the past.
Exactly, and I think disease always has those two elements of a biological element, but also this sort of sense of violation. And with AIDS, we recognized that there wasn't much in the early years we could do to cure this.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there was a huge violation taking place with the patient. And in our inability to offer anything but ourselves, we stumbled onto this old-fashioned horse and buggy art, which was the Ministry of Healing. They didn't
That's
have
right.
much cure, but by God, they were able to bring comfort.
Right.
So I'm not frustrated as much as I have a sense of humility, that, and I'm ashamed that it took a disease like this for us to be open to this aspect of medicine.
When we speak of AIDS, Dr. Verghese, there is the technical, medical, biophysical kind of thing that goes on with research and the development of AZT, that sort of thing, very, very sophisticated medical work. On the other side, there is, as you are implying here, a series of metaphors and a series of conceits that we use to understand what is going on with what a lot of people refer to as a modern plague. What should be our conceits and metaphorical language? How should we talk to ourselves about this?
It would be ideal if we could talk about this disease as a viral infection with mild, moderate, and severe phases, and right now an ultimately fatal viral infection. And it's extraordinary that this disease should carry with it such a huge metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
In that small town, Johnson City, I began to feel as though I was treating two diseases. There was the virus, and then there was this huge metaphor of shame and guilt that eclipsed the virus. And in at least one instance, I lost a patient to the metaphor. Talk about metaphors not being powerful.
Right.
He basically had found out he was infected, and 2 weeks passed, and he took his life at a time when the virus was doing nothing because of what it meant. And, you know, if you ask what's the source of that metaphor, clearly it stems from our inability as a society to come to terms with the existence of gay people within our society. That's why this disease has a metaphor.
How did they themselves understand what was happening to them? I mean, was there a lot of talk, for example, about biblical visitations and the hand of God and things like that, or did you conduct the conversation on a medical level?
You know, it was almost two different conversations with the sons, and for the most part I was taking care of gay young men who were coming back from big cities, and with the families. And I was struck by the fact that as an outsider, first of all, you don't get to hear many of the stereotypes about the South. Or if you do hear them, you don't really factor them in as heavily as, you know, someone who's grown up in America all along keeps hearing about the South. So I was perhaps immune to some of the stereotypes. And it struck me that prejudice, whether extreme religious fever or, a bigoted prejudice, in the abstract was all very well. But it seemed to sort of dissolve away when you were confronted with an immediate problem, particularly when kin were involved. It always seemed to me that kinship erased any prejudice. And parents had a very hard time. They were dealing with two pieces of information at the same time, typically, that their son was gay and that he had AIDS and he was now coming back.
You put your finger on a wonderful paradox in modern American and Southern culture, I suppose. That is to say, the sort of underlying element of racism, suspicion of people of color on the one side, and then the powerful force of family and, as you say, kin,
right,
in the way that these folks relate to one another. Did that eventually prove to be a continuity or a contradiction?
I think it actually proved to be the salvation. I think that, you know, if this book was merely a collection of poignant tales from the South, it wouldn't have the response it's getting. And I don't mean sales, I mean the sort of emotional response.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the flip side of this awful, awful disease is the way people came through. Families often said to me, and patients, that, you know, he might have lived another 40 years in his city and we would never have connected with our son, never have known him but for this awful disease. And young men expressed the same thing. So I think ultimately it's a testimony to how at the tail end of a life, family and relationships probably have more value and meaning than many of the things we pursue, like fame, fortune, and
right.
so on.
Tell me about some of the men. I take it was almost exclusively a male clientele here. Tell me about some of the men that you treated. You write about, I'm sure that these are pseudonyms, Will Johnson, Ed, Petey, Clyde, Norman.
Yeah.
Give me a specific sense here of what you did.
Well, I think the one man whose story sticks out in my mind, among many others, is Hobart, because he illustrated the paradigm that came to explain why this town should have such extraordinary numbers of infected persons. Hobart remembers growing up and at the age of 8 walking through the schoolyard with his brother, who turns to him and says, "Must you walk that way?" And it was his first sense that the way he walked was in some way different from
that's right, an outsider and yet inside.
Exactly, and so these differences stacked up, and not surprisingly, he went to San Francisco and had a wonderful job there, was very happy, then became ill, lost his job, lost his apartment, and made the one call that he must have dreaded making to his parents to say, I have AIDS and I'm coming home.
Well, this brings us back to that opening passage that we heard you read. This young man who's coming to Johnson City, Tennessee, and he's got this awful burden, not only of the disease, but of what he has to communicate about.
Absolutely. And so he came home, and he became very ill, and I put him in the hospital, and I couldn't sort out his fever. And ultimately he died. And before he died, he'd call me up and he said, Abraham, when I die, I don't want an autopsy, but if you like, you can come to my house after I die and take some biopsies of my organs, and that way you'll know what happened. And I guess he knew I'd been doing that fairly often in that town. And I remember going to his room and being absolutely struck, not just by the sight of his body, and his body was amazing because he looked almost Christ-like in that white diaper and wasted away and long stringy hair, but more than that, it was to look around this childhood room of his, a room that he'd presumably grown up with much love, and yet the icons on this childhood room were not his. They were his mother's. They were these needlepoint verses and a picture of Christ at Gethsemane. And I had seen pictures of his apartment in San Francisco with his sort of vision of the world displayed there. And at that moment, it struck me as incredibly tragic that this young man had made this sort of heroic escape and had been sort of forced back. And yet there'd been salvation, there'd been love, there'd been sort of reconciliation. But I mentioned this anecdote because it was at that moment in his room standing there that I thought about the scientific paper I would write describing this migration, but also knew that the words of science couldn't begin to capture his heroism, the heartache of his family, or my own sense of grief living through this again and again.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what how you take the measure of the impact of AIDS in again, modern American mass culture, and particularly in the South, in Johnson City, Tennessee, in terms of what we call the way gender, the way we talk about sexuality, men being men, women being women. I mean, this is, after all, the South, where men are supposed to be men, that macho ethic. How did your work run up against that?
Well, I think more than anything else, I underwent a personal transformation. I think I began the story, I won't say homophobic, but certainly homo-ignorant. All I had were the usual stereotypes that we are taught in college and all the bad taste jokes that we trot out.
Yeah, you said you actually participated in them. I mean,
not
to sound a negative note here, but you became part of this anti-gay culture, or suspicious.
Yeah, as much as any college student who you know, really doesn't have an open mind. And I think the wonderful part of this experience was that I came out the other end with not just empathy, but a strong sense of regret that it took a disease like this for this to happen, but also a sense that what gay men had taught me more than anything else was to teach me about what it is to be a man. And I don't mean the sexual aspects. To continue with your thought, so much of what passes for manliness in our culture, this machoism that we engage in, isn't really manliness as much as it is a kind of posturing, a kind of fiction that males think they have to engage in for women. This is what's required of us.
You talk about a conversation with your spouse. Remind me of her name?
Rajini. Yes.
And you're talking about men being with men, not in a sexual sense, but being away from women and not having the influence, the power, however you describe that, of women in their lives.
That's right. So when you see gay men who are not, if anything, they're not posturing for women, whatever else they're doing, you begin to see what this full spectrum of maleness can include, especially emotionally, and there are many things there to learn about manliness. And I'm also particularly struck that the one thing that heterosexual males use to point at and single out gay men as being particularly distressing to them, namely the anonymous sex, the multiple partners, may in fact be the thing that they have most in common with gay men, inasmuch as I think in most heterosexual encounters between men and women, the woman is often the gatekeeper. And but for her gatekeeping, I'm sure heterosexual men would willingly engage in anonymous sex, multiple partners. And if we have any doubt about that, all we need to do is look at the billion-dollar prostitution and pornography industry, which caters almost exclusively to men.
What did you say, Dr. Verghese, to either individuals or to that sort of cultural institutional sense that surely exists in Johnson City, Tennessee, and elsewhere in the country, that this is really what these guys deserve, that they have brought this upon themselves, that this is, it's too bad. They are running into their fate, and this is what God or whatever is out there actually intends for them. This sense of punishment and retribution that seems to be an undercurrent in the way many Americans respond to AIDS.
It was a very difficult thing to fight. I mean, Jerry Falwell and others were spouting this kind of rhetoric all the time, and it was easy for people to buy into it in the abstract. Our parents, who were very religious and then had a gay son come back with AIDS, were immediately put into a conflict and almost immediately sided with their son and wound up abandoning the religious rhetoric. There's one character in this book who I call Will Johnson, a heterosexual male, a pillar of his community, who got this in a transfusion, gave it to his wife, got this disease. And he said something which seems to have affected many people who otherwise would be prejudiced. At one point, he's sitting in Duke University, actually, in a waiting room next to a outlandish gay male who's being very obnoxious and shrill about not getting his service on time. And Will Johnson turns to his son and he says, you know, this disease is not from God. Don't ever make that mistake. It's not God's retribution. This is from Satan himself.
You also
and that's affected a lot of people, turned them around, I think.
Indeed. You write about the way that Will Johnson's son responds to what is happening to his parents. Tell me quickly about that.
Well, for a long time the son was excluded from all this because the father had become susceptible to the metaphor. He thought, I mean, the metaphor of shame was so huge that he didn't even tell his son till very late. But the son was ready to sort of express animosity to gay males, having perceived them as being at the root cause of his father's illness. And that's when his father turned to him and says, you know, you don't put this on any one person. Don't even put this on God. This is from the devil himself. And
right.
It's, anyone who has this, Jesus has a special fondness for. This was his own words. He was a very religious man. And I think that changed his son's mind.
Let's talk for a moment, Dr. Verghese, about, we've been speaking of the sort of literary and cultural and personal response here to your work as a physician working with infectious diseases. What is happening with the way the medical community is responding to the AIDS? What's the proper term here? Epidemic?
Clearly epidemic, yeah.
Help me to understand this.
Well, I think that in a way, when I look at the book now, it almost seems as though it's about a nostalgic period in the history of this disease, because
we're going to beat it. The answer will come here sooner.
Not so much because of that, but because of the community response.
Uh-huh.
In that period, I felt the burden of this disease was entirely on my shoulders. I really couldn't look around for community support, and the miracle of the last 10 years has been the huge power of community-based organizations, hospices, Ryan White money, caseworkers, almost an institution that's burgeoned in the community, which, for example, in El Paso, I now take care of 5 times the number of patients I describe in this book, and yet it feels less intense personally than it did then. That's been the big story. Also, I think as a medical community, when this disease appeared initially, it was kind of like a litmus test, and you had to decide which side you lined up on. And now, even if it still serves as a litmus test, people will be loath to admit that. And the generation of medical students now coming out, I'm really excited by, because they've heard about this from high school, pre-med, college, and they've embraced it as part of what they will deal with. They don't see it as something they're going to have to choose whether they work with or not. To take that thought further, I am for the first time in many years encouraged medically by some of the new developments. I think that I've always felt that we'll never wake up and hear that there's a magic bullet that's going to wipe out this disease. I've always held that the model would be something more like diabetes, where we don't cure diabetes, but we do manage to control it and push back the complications so that they happen at the tail end of a productive life. And recent developments, again, none of them by themselves being very important, but you stack them up with all the incremental gains we've made. And in the last year, I've had the distinct sense that we've turned that corner, and this could be a disease modeled after diabetes.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Dr. Verghese. What for you has been the greatest reward, the greatest fear? I mean, if you to take the conversation and work it to extremes here, do the rewards outweigh the fears and the down moments?
I think the rewards have been extraordinary, and I think people often look at those of us who work in this field and pity us even and think we must be stressed and burnt out. But in a funny way, I think that we get much more out of it than anyone realizes. I think our society is particularly obsessed with the personal pronoun, I, your inner child, you're out of this. And I think the great secret is that when you're outwardly engaged with others, the I disappears, and it's an extraordinarily satisfying specialty to be in. Nurses, social workers, we all feel like we've found our calling. No one needs to pity us. Far from it, we're getting much more out of it. My fear is that as many gains as we've made, every now and then something happens that reminds us we're still at step one. For example, the Secret Service donning gloves to screen people who have come to talk to the president about this. And, you know, that takes you so far back that you almost despair. But then you encounter another family, another individual transformed by this disease, another social worker or nurse who exemplifies something so special that you're inspired again.
A quick footnote to our conversation, Dr. Verghese. Do you think of yourself as participating in a tradition of medical anthropology, literary accounts? I think of people like Walker Percy, for example, the physician who became a novelist. In what part of the universe do you put yourself there?
Oh, I would be honored to have my name mentioned in the same breath. I think of myself more as a working physician who writes about the craft. I'm trying to be much more of a writer, but I think they're intimately connected. I couldn't be writing without also seeing patients. That's part of what I do.
Abraham Verghese is professor of medicine and chief of infectious diseases at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center in El Paso, Texas. His book, My Own Country, A Doctor's Story, is available from Vintage Books. My Own Country was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Nonfiction. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial funding for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was physician and writer Abraham Verghese. Audio tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 795. That's $10, program number 795. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Friendship Through the Ages. Join me for a conversation with classic scholar David Constant of Brown University. David Constant will be here to discuss his new study of the literature and meanings of friendship in societies from ancient to modern. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.